Hey, here we are again with another episode of Old School Guns, the podcast that has the information, opinion, and the answers that you want to know. And let's just get right after it. Apparently, there was a House subcommittee hearing on reparations. And at first, you know, this just sounds ridiculous on the surface. But, you know, some people obviously think they're owed something. And maybe having a hearing isn't a bad thing. But what I will say is, you know, slavery's been over with for 150 years. The people who were held in slavery are now gone. The slave owners are now gone. So going back and trying to litigate that and remedy it through financial means is wrong. You know, this, they try to tie this into privilege and everything else. You know, you can never make history right, and two wrongs don't make a right, and reparations are just flat wrong. Just look, would Michael Jordan get reparations? I mean, he's probably descended from slaves, but he's a fantastically wealthy and successful man, so would he get reparations? Would Colin Powell, who was another, you know, who is another wealthy and successful man, I think he was descended from people from the West Indies who may have been held in slaves by the British, but I don't know that he is a descendant of American slave owners. He might be, who knows. But would he get reparations? Would Barack Obama, who has no ties to slavery through his family, but he is black, would he get reparations? And the answer is you really couldn't determine who should get reparations and who shouldn't. What if a person takes a DNA test and says, well, I'm 2% sub-Saharan African, therefore I deserve reparations? Is there a cutoff? Can you be you have to be African enough to get them? And even then, there's no guarantee that simply because you have the DNA that says that you know, you're a descendant of slaves. So, I mean, it's just obviously not going to happen and can't practically work. And it just shows you the mentality of looking backwards and not looking forwards. People should look forwards and say, you know what, the true reparations and true opportunity of America is the education system, is the ability to get a good job, make something of yourself. It's really about the future, because you can never remediate or correct the past. That's one thing that was a hard lesson in the Balkans. Essentially, everybody's worried about who did what to whom decades or even hundreds of years ago. And the fact of the matter is that just hinders them moving forward. Same thing with the reparations argument here. Next thing to move on to, Mr. David Hogg says he has been the victim of 7 assassination attempts. I mean, this guy's a nut. I mean, and you know, you read that and you go, you can't be serious. There's no police reports. There's no news reports. This is him making this foolish claim. You know, and what it sounds like, remember H. Ross Perot, that, you know, Dan Quayle, if I don't drop out of the race, Dan Quayle of all people, is going to come disrupt my daughter's wedding, or, you know, back during the Vietnam War, the Viet Cong were going to send a hit squad to Texas to take me out, and, you know, this goes on and on. There's, you know, wild claims of all this stuff. It almost borders on this conspiracy theory stuff. And all it is just a sad, pathetic ploy to get attention. So the least attention you pay to someone like that, the better. It's absolutely ludicrous. The next one is one of my favorites, Governor Northam of Virginia. The guy who was nearly kicked out of office because they found his college yearbook, and there's a picture of him in blackface, and obviously he had the nickname Coon Man as an obvious affront and insult to black people. And, you know, the school did an investigation and said, hey, there's no mistake. That was not a mistaken picture put in there, which at first he'd claimed. Then he claimed he was a Michael Jackson fan and was blackface another time. Here's a guy who in his younger life, you know, courted all this stuff. You know, I mean, who really wants to go around in blackface and thinks that's funny or thinks that is in any way appropriate? You know, it's not 1900. You know, this happened in the 1980s, and he certainly knew better. But he did it anyway. You know, here's a guy. And the only reason he didn't get kicked out is because the deputy governor or lieutenant governor, whatever they call it in Virginia, was a black guy. And he was going to be the natural successor until they found out he was a serious and apparently a serial sexual assaulter. So you have these two terrible people with absolutely no character. And that's what the Democratic Party has brought you. People of Virginia, that's what you've gotten. And you need to stand up to these guys. They're going to try to hold some special session on gun violence or some nonsense, which is just going to be a veil for some idiotic gun control. It's like they don't have a gun problem. They have a people problem. And it starts right up at the top. It starts at the top. They lack the character to lead. They lack the character to give any kind of moral guidance or be a compass of any kind. They're really despicable. And they have to go. And don't cooperate with them on this gun control nonsense they're trying to push. It's just a deflection. It's just a way that they're trying to get the heat off their own despicable backsides. Okay, and the gift that keeps on giving, the NRA, more drama. You know, and I'm starting, there was an Ammo Land column where it basically says, you know, enough's enough. I'm paraphrasing, they don't use that term, but, you know, and I'm rapidly reaching that point. The good news is they're dumping NRA TV, which was, you know, never very impressive. It really wasn't. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, they've got some talented people and they can present some things, but when they're trying to fill a lot of airtime, the quality I didn't feel was ever really there. But they're finally dumping, and I hope they get rid of this Dana Loesch person, or Loesch, however she pronounces it. She's a very appealing spokesperson. She's certainly very attractive. She's certainly well-spoken. She presents well. She publicly speaks well. I mean, she was really pretty good. The deal is, though, she's a Republican and not necessarily a gun rights person. I mean, what is her shooting background? And this is the problem I have with some of this NRA stuff. And it starts at the top stops at the figurehead top. Who is Carolyn Meadows? What is her shooting resume? Is she just another rich FUD who, you know, likes to go to all the parties and do all this and be a big advocate? Or does she have any shooting resume or chops? Does she have any, as they used to say, skin in the game? I mean, or is this just something she does? Same thing with Wayne LaPierre. You know, his bio always kind of describes him as, well, he's a, you know, kind of a local competitor and does some shooting. I've never really seen any pictures of him with firearms shooting, although I'm sure there's some publicity shots. But shoot, we had those of Barack Obama with the shotgun the one or two times he visited Camp David. And the same thing with Chris Cox. I think shooters kind of... We need people with some shooting background and resumes and not just advocates or people who do certain things. And I understand they got to know how Washington works and all the rest of this. But, you know, I just feel that there isn't some skin in the game. And, you know, personally, they don't really have anything to lose if some of these gun control things happen. I mean, I don't like bump stocks. I don't think anything good ever came of them. But, you know, it's just like in 1986, the Hughes Amendment. Obviously, that didn't affect a lot of the NRA leadership. You know, they weren't into fully automatic Class 3 weapons, so they didn't care. You know, they didn't tell Ronald Reagan, no, you need to veto this. and kick it back and make them pass the version without the Hughes Amendment. No, they didn't say that. They took it and ran because really the restriction in there didn't affect them. So they weren't really looking out for us. It was short-sighted and it wasn't very smart. What I don't like about this whole thing is, you know, to me, Ackerman McQueen are, I suppose they're the villains. And I say that because I believe that they have infiltrated the NRA with the Dana Lashes and maybe a few of these other people to turn it into a Republican phalangist organization. You know, when there's talking during an NRA commercial about immigration and about this and about that, all they're doing is using NRA money to push another agenda, and they're trying to turn us into a little Republican phalangist organization. And I say that, and I'm a pretty staunch conservative, and I agree with a lot of the things they say about these other issues, but I think NRA is gun rights first. And I think that, you know, you can't chase away anybody who doesn't agree with this. It has to stand alone. It cannot be part of this comprehensive political agenda. It stands alone. And that means that we can welcome people who normally would not agree with some of these other Ackerman McQueen pushed positions, because we should be, the NRA should be a gun rights organization. The other thing I'm sick and tired of is they seem to be taking a lot of these actions and they're not informing anybody. They're not putting out squat. And I think that the second vice president, Willis Lee, and I think some of these board members need to get together and tell us what is going on. Why was Chris Cox suspended? Was he an Ackerman McQueen stooge? Was he just wanted to get rid of Wayne LaPierre because he thought his time has passed and that he's brought dissent to the organization? I mean, we want to start knowing this stuff. They are spending members' money, and they are accountable to us. And part of that is telling us the deal. We're all adults. Tell us the deal. And the last thing I don't like is it's obviously apparent to everyone that the NRA president is a figurehead, and it gets installed essentially on the with the approval of the CEO and Wayne LaPierre. He is right now the NRA. Anybody who seems to oppose him kind of goes away. I mean, I think there are a few board members who oppose him. I think Alan West is one of them. I'm not sure, but he seems to have made some statements of that. I just don't want this to be a one-man autocratic organization. I mean, if it's time for him to go, it's time for him to go. If he's got a compelling reason why he should stay, i.e. saying, hey, we trusted Ackerman McQueen for decades, and you know what, in the last 4 or 5 years, they've strayed and they've pulled us along on a different political path. And so I'm trying to get rid of them, and this is all the blowback because they've got their tentacles inside the organization. Hey, if that's the explanation, I'm good with that. Let's go. Let's do it. Let's get rid of them. Let's sue them. And, you know, that'll all get solved in court and all that. But anyway, this is the gift that keeps on giving, but everybody's starting to reach their patience limit. And so if they don't start explaining stuff, then Wayne LaPierre's head will be on a platter. I mean, we can find someone else to run the NRA and be more open. We need some definite transparency. And I'm not giving credence to these, you know, the pipsqueaks I talked about in previous podcasts. I'm not very impressed with you know, these guys. Hey, my daddy lost an election for first vice president to Charlton Heston. Hey, I'm real sorry about that. You know, tough. That was 20-some years ago. So, you know, basically, you know, take your marbles and go home. I don't really care about what a good YouTube provider you are and how you're such a genius. I mean, you know, frankly, those guys are all, they're all out for themselves, or they all have an axe to grind from decades ago. And they're really not in the here and now with all this. I want to be in the here and now with all this. And, you know, get it solved. We got elections coming up, And we have, you know, there's always the continual cycle of threats against gun ownership. So that's the one for the opinion and the commentary on the 2A. So let's go to my favorite part of the show, which is questions and answers. And this comes to us, this first question is gonna be kind of lengthy because it's a complex question. It comes to us from a friend of the podcast who is a good gun handler. I mean, this guy's got the skills. He can handle firearms, all kinds. Everything from pistols, black powder, shotguns, and I'm talking high-end shotguns, and military rifles, and you know, civilian sporting rifles, all this stuff. The guy's got good skills. And he asked a question, which is very probing and is going to be very complex. And that question is, how can I get advanced training with firearms? And what he's talking about is acquiring skills that are beyond what we would call square range skills. You know, you can safely handle a firearm. You can be a very, very good marksman with a firearm and shoot great scores on the square range. And you can also be a person who can shoot in competition and take the pressure and all those things that go get into the right mindset, take the pressure of competition, overcome all of that and do well. But how do you translate that into practical skill sets for the street or any kind of a home defense or any kind of just general fighting situation with firearms? And that could run the gamut from home defense to zombie apocalypse, okay? You could say there's a whole broad spectrum in there, and what skills do you need beyond being a great square range gun handler and shooter? What do you need to basically advance yourself? So I will kind of go, and what I will say will PO a lot of people. I mean, there'll be a lot of people who won't like this. But I will say one thing. There's a difference between training and education. And a lot of people who've been in training as opposed to education know this. Education, you can educate me on an F-16. Tell me what all the controls are and how they work and all the rest of this without me ever even touching the console, being in the cockpit and touching anything or being in a simulator. I could be educated on that and I could recite that back to you. I could tell you all this stuff and that's good to know stuff. But I'm not trained to fly it. Training is more the application of education, and it's done over and over and over again so that you become an expert. You can almost do it, I don't want to say without thinking about it, but it almost becomes reflexive movement that happens. And so how do you get from the square range where you're shooting on your own, plinking on your own, or shooting NRA bullseye, how do you get from the square range to, you know, Indian country or the red zone, whatever you want to call it? How do you get from there to there? Well, one of the ways is to go the training route of, you know, courses and trainers. And there's more courses and trainers out there than anybody can count. It started with Gunsight in Arizona as a place where you could go and learn what they deemed to be practical skills with firearms. And that was basically advanced firearm handling and some situational vignettes that you could go through, learn to shoot, learn how to engage multiple targets, how to you know, do a controlled pair on targets, how to, you know, do all this kind of stuff, combat reloads, all these good things. And that's evolved over the years, and there's still a preeminent training facility. There have been a lot of others. And there are some people who are really good at it, and there are some people who are probably not so good at it. But one of the formulas that these places have is you know, just like anything else, they're a business and they're there to sell. So it's very difficult for them. They're there to make money, straight up. And so what they're going to do is they're going to say, you've got to take my basic class first, then you take my intermediate class, then my advanced class, and then maybe individual instruction or something like that beyond that. You know, that's just a model. Not all of them do that, but a lot of them do. Or I should say, at least some of them do. And what I'm getting at here is, at whatever level you are, and if you're like the guy who asked this question, and you're a good gun handler and all that, well, you're probably going to have to suffer through some basic firearm safety. This is how you load. This is how you shoot. Basic square range kind of stuff. It's almost as if you knew nothing, and you have to take their basic course. And that's going to cost you some money. And it's going to cost you time. And then you progress through their ladder of classes until you feel you've learned what you want to learn. So that's one route to go. Now, when you evaluate that kind of thing, training is almost never fun, okay? Training is not Disneyland. And some of these places, I'm sure, are kind of shooter Disneylands. You know, you're out there, they teach a few techniques, and then you go out and you shoot all these great targets. And at the end of the day, you're patting yourself on the back. And at the end of the week, because these things are usually 3-4 days long, You've shot 1,000 rounds and you really feel good. You've gotten a lot of practice and all that. But unless it's been difficult and probably in some ways unpleasant, it's really not training. It's entertainment and not training. Training is repetitive. Sometimes it is very boring. It works on a lot of basics. And I'm not sure that a lot of these schools, you know, they want it to be a fun thing, so you come back. So they want to build in a certain amount of fun. They want to build up your ego and all that. A lot of training is you've got to be very self-critical and say, yeah, I really screwed this up, and I need to do better. And I'm sure some of these courses have some of that, but basically they want you to leave happy. And I'm sure that what they tell you is, you are so much improved now as opposed to when you showed up. And whether that's true or not is probably marketing. So the other aspect of this is they will definitely, they'll have perhaps a pro shop, or, you know, it'll be that kind of look-alike monkey see, monkey do. Hey, this is the holster he uses. I better get that holster too. Or he had this modification to his gun. I better get that too. And these are the pants he wore, so I better get a pair of those. And it goes on and on. It, just like a lot of sports and other activities, people just start throwing money at all this. And so that's one of the things you have to worry about with training. It's you can definitely throw a lot of money at something. And then you walk out with perhaps individual skills and all these things. But what is the plan? What is the plan to maintain those skills? I mean, you can take, yes, some of it will stay with you, but there's got to be a practice regimen that reinforces those skills so that they don't attrit away. You just don't forget them. Or, well, I went to this course 3 years ago, and now I'm where I was before I took it because I never practiced anything. That's the difference between entertainment and training. You go there 3 years ago, you were entertained, you feel great, you feel like you accomplished a lot, but now you realize that that's all gone and you have to start over again, as opposed to continually doing something to maintain some level of those skills. Maybe not as good as you were when you walked out of the course, but you definitely want to maintain some of that. And that's where reflective practice comes in. I will also tell you that there's no set group of skills that fits everyone. If you're active duty military or law enforcement, what you probably want to learn might be different and will be different than an armed civilian who's worried more about home defense, keeping my family safe, kind of a deal. And if that person is a concealed carrier, in real life as opposed to a law enforcement or SWAT or military guy, you know, when you start talking about the skills beyond operating the weapon, you know, efficiently and all this, when you start talking about skills beyond that, you really have to start looking. When you're an armed civilian, you really want to get away from trouble. You don't ride towards the sound of the guns. You go away from them. So a lot of our range training, and you see this in three gun and even in the videos of the two gun matches and other things, they're continually going forward, like they're going towards the conflict. As an armed citizen, you actually want to be moving away, and you want to be using your weapon to give you some standoff, discourage people from following you, whether you're suppressing them or hitting them and then moving back and away. You want distance between you and the bad people. You want distance, because distance is safety. It's harder for them to hurt you at distance. It's easier when they're up close. It's easier. So, and you want your family behind you. You want them moving back. And you want to be the shield, but you want to be continually moving away while at the same time stopping the bad people from closing the distance. So, ideally, you want to fix their position, have them stop, and you keep moving back to such point as you can just skedaddle out of there, and it's over. So, you know, that's a very different skill set than taking down a building or being a tier one operator and going into the compound and shooting Osama bin Laden. Those are all different skill sets. So you have to look at who's offering the skill set you really want. The defensive driving so you can escape something is good. And also is preventing your car from being jacked and having the situational awareness to stay away from places which are just naturally dangerous. Those are all parts of different skill sets. If I'm a tier one operator on a national mission force, and my deal is to take down the building of bad guys, the skills I'm looking for are a lot different, and no one school is going to show me as the homeowner protecting my family, or the guy just trying to get away from trouble when we're out on the street, as opposed to the tier one operator trying to take down the building of bad guys. So those are some things that should be under consideration. I would say just understand that there's a huge marketing blitz, and you know they want you to purchase a lot of expensive stuff. I mean, it goes to the question of how good is good. I was listening to something the other day where they said, well, you know, if you're not all that serious, something like a Daniel Defense AR-15 is good enough. And these guys are shooting apparently $3,000 and $4,000 custom ARs and all this. I sit there and I kind of take a back at that, because, you know, Daniel Defense is really excellent. For most homeowners, that's an outstanding gun. And in fact, there are a lot of outstanding guns. You know, I shoot a Double Star, which a lot of people, yeah, I don't even know if they're still in business anymore. But, you know, they produced a basic AR that works, and the thing's been working for years. I mean, eventually I'll shoot the barrel out and have to replace the barrel, but the other inner workings and all that are fine. So, you know, what is good enough? You know, sometimes the top end. I always believe you should buy the best equipment you can afford, but that does not necessarily mean buying the latest and greatest or stuff that's way beyond the capability you need. Sometimes it's smart just to go back and say, hey, well, what were the kind of the top end guys using a couple of years ago? And you can find out that was some pretty good equipment. It's not the latest and greatest, but it's probably well beyond anything you would ever need, and it's more economically priced. You know, we've all seen these magazines over every, every couple of months, the fore ends of these ARs. It's like, well, it was the 16-inch barrel, and then it was the 18-inch barrel. Then they go back to the 20-inch barrel. And then you watch, they'll be back at the 16 at some point. And then I need a heavier barrel, except when I want to save weight, then I need a lighter barrel. I mean, you know, it's all confusing out there. It's all confusing. And part of the education part of training is kind of determining what your requirements really, really are. Most of us are not, and will never be, top-end, tier one operators or, you know, big city SWAT guys that are going to be confronting a complex threat. It's just not going to happen. So sound basic equipment may be a better choice. Stuff you can train with, stuff you can understand, stuff that you can take on and off, and basically stuff that you're not afraid to train with. You know, you buy a $1,600 sight and put it on a $600 rifle. Human nature is most people are going to treat that like it's made out of glass. No pun intended, but most people are going to treat it like that. And so are you really training? Now, if you put on the $200 piece of glass, and hey, it gets messed up, well, you know, you can always get another one. It's not going to be that, it's not going to, you know, bust the budget like the top ender will. And it's probably going to be just as good. You know, and also, do you really need a lot of magnification? You know, for CQB, which is kind of home defense, or, you know, there's bad people in the neighborhood, you know, think of something like, you know, the Boston Marathon bombers gone amok, where maybe you got a group of these guys who are terrorizing a neighborhood. You probably don't need a lot of magnification. You probably don't need any. And maybe an EOTech, which is still pretty reasonably priced, or an EOTech clone, maybe even that's going to be just as good. And there are all kinds of sites out there that are either red dot or holographic or some other, you know, clone type things, and some of them are actually pretty good. I have not used them, but I think the HoloSun is a very interesting piece of kit that, you know, what I like about it is all it needs is sunshine to keep it powered, and you don't have to worry about batteries going south at exactly the wrong minute. So I definitely think that equipment choice and what skill set you want is going to drive the kind of training that you want and need. And you have to just be an adult and realize good training is not going to be fun. It's not going to be that entertaining. And you're going to go home pooped. And you may not go home, you know, revved like you just, you know, the cheerleaders just gave you the cheer and you're the big football hero. No, it's going to be tough. It's going to be gritty, sweaty, and but that's going to be worthwhile. And when you leave, you should say, I can really do a lot of different things that I didn't think I could do before under those kind of conditions. And to wrap this up, I'll just say a couple things. If I'm selecting a trainer, I want him to ask me what my goals are to make sure that he has a course or some kind of offering that meets that. He should be talking to me as much as advertising and marketing. If they're just putting out telling what their course does and not asking what you need and what you're looking for, then you're essentially buying exactly what they sell, whether it fits you or not. And so I would be very, very careful. There's a lot of guys out there, as I said before. Everybody since September 11th, 2001, everybody with a military DD-214 and served in any kind of a special, especially if they served in special operations or a very active type of unit like infantry or something else. Deployed police officers, the same thing, you know, guys with badges, all this experience and all that. There are a lot of different trainers out there, and they're waving their resumes around, and you know, be very careful the ones you choose. The ones that I think are the funniest are the great ones. And that's, you know, and that's a lot of those skills that we talk about are for street. You know, you think of buildings and streets and parking lots and parking garages, all kinds of places where you would conceivably be in a defense shooting situation. You know, restaurant type things where, hey, you're carrying, all of a sudden something very bad breaks out. But then there's also the woods factor, out in the boonies, and the basic patrolling and all that. And I always like it when they they dig up these ex-Russian Spetsnaz guys. You know, they find these guys somewhere, they dry them out, because usually these guys are pretty vodka soaked, and they dry them out, and you're taking lessons from 350-pound Vasily, and he was in Afghanistan in 1979, and I mean, it goes on and on, and so understand that when you're talking about skills, you're also talking about, there's this piece that's kind of on top of it that covers patrolling and sniping and all these what would seem to be more military type skills, and that's pretty much a another market that you if you really want those skills, that's going to, you can play fun out in the forest, or you can train and actually do it. And I don't think that you're going to find the type of rigorous training that most people go through who operate and do that as a living. I mean, you might find an introduction to patrolling and kind of do some of that, but it's going to be very, very rudimentary and basic. But if you want to learn that kind of stuff, that's where you have to start, and find guys who served in Ranger battalions, or find even the old Spetsnaz guys. All these things are the fundamentals of patrolling, combat patrols, reconnaissance patrols. All those things are basically the same in every army. Moving in a wedge, moving in a file, passing up the count, the hand and arm signals, how to do an L-shaped ambush, all that stuff is the same. So, you can kind of get that the flavor of that anywhere. That's really more of a prepper or survivalist oriented type of activity. But you can't find it out there, and it'd certainly be entertaining. And if you just want to learn some precision shooting, understanding that a sniper is probably 80% field craft and observation and all this other stuff, and 20% marksmanship. A precision rifle course would probably be something that would be very valuable, but you have to link that. You just can't take a PRS shooter and say, hey, you're a sniper. Doesn't work that way. There's a whole lot of other skills that go along with it. It's like myself. I'm a pretty fair pistol shot, but that doesn't mean I can be a policeman. A policeman has to know a lot more things in addition to pistol shooting. And I would say that to be a successful policeman, it seems like odd to us, but pistol shooting is probably halfway down on his list. You've got to know a lot of legal things, incredible amount of procedures, because police departments operate on procedures. And so there's a whole architecture of behavior and performance and everything else that they essentially demand. And face it, shooting your service weapon is just buried in there somewhere. So just because you're good at that does not mean you'll be a good policeman. So same thing with precision shooting. Just because you can hit a target at 500 yards, no problem, and do it very consistently, hit a small target at 500 yards, that does not make you a sniper. That does not, and neither does reading books or watching DVDs. It's a very, very unique skill, and in many ways, it's a very, very high-end skill, even in the military. They don't even want to call the designated marksmen snipers anymore, although that's what they are. But just be careful. If somebody offers you a sniper course and it just turns out to be precision shooting, you're not a sniper when you come out of that. Language sells, but be very wary, because it's your pocketbook, and their job is to get as much money out of there as possible. You know, it's they're a lot of these guys are great guys and they got great service records and everything, but you will find that you know, their job is to sell and make money, and they got house payments, car payments, and you know, kids who need braces just like everybody else. So they're going to definitely try to sell you. Here's another question that came from somebody where I work, actually. Do you think Brownells will come out with a legitimate AR-180 as opposed to just the upper that fits on the AR-15 lower? And I can say is I don't know what they'll do. I suspect they're investigating that possibility. I don't know that anybody's going to be really excited over the upper that fits on the AR-15 lower. It certainly doesn't do anything for me. I would say that, you know, the AR-180 has failed several times. I mean, the originals failed. Even when the production was transferred to different places, it basically failed in the 1970s. Armalite tried to bring it back with a polymer lower. And I think Nodak Spud actually produced a metal lower. A metal lower that you could replace that with and kind of build one. But I think if Brownells and Nodak Spud get together again like they have for the retro ARs, you could definitely see a legit AR-180 come out, and the only difference would be that it just has to take M16 pattern magazines, AR-15 M16 magazines, has to do that. And if it does, it's got a reasonable chance of living on in the retro market. Who would have thought even a year or 2 years ago that we would see an AR-10 retro, that we would see all the varieties of AR-15 retros that we've seen, you know, the whole line of rifles. If they're selling, it only makes sense, economic sense, that they would expand it. And I think they about have every of the every model covered up to the A2. They haven't done an A2 yet, and they might, but I think the AR-180 would be a very interesting addition to that. And it always comes down to cost. You got to look what are the originals selling for, and can they make a new one that is essentially going to be able to undersell what the originals are going for? Because when that, you know, one of the market dynamics is that when they introduce the if they introduced one, guess what? The prices of the originals are going to come down because the people who there's a certain segment of the market who will say, well, I'll be satisfied with the new rifle from Brownells as opposed to the older rifle, you know, and whether that's 10%, 20%, 25%, whatever percentage that is, that means that the demand is going to go down for originals, and therefore one can assume the price would either stabilize or go down a little bit also. The same thing happened with cowboy action shooting in the Winchester model 1873. You know, there were so many good reproductions out there that the originals for a long time stabilized and actually kind of lost some money. It was just simply because a lot of people who wanted a 73 were satisfied with a copy, a rifle or carbine that they could actually take out and shoot. They didn't have to worry about finish wear and it losing value. And also, there were also some calibers that were made available, that 45 Colt being the example, but also you can get them in 38, 357, calibers that weren't available in the originals. So, you know, there was a slice of the market that said, yeah, we'll take this, and, you know, the originals can just be the originals. And, you know, I watched the prices on those for a long time, and it's only been recently that the 73s have kind of bounced back and have started really gaining value again. But so an AR-180 would be a great addition to Brownell's line, and I think they'd be smart to bring it out. They'd be very smart to bring it out. And like I said, the winner, the deal on that is it's got to take the M16 pattern magazines. And if it does that, Shoot, they're rocking and rolling. Well, this wraps it up for another episode of Old School Guns. Remember to hit the follower button and leave us comments, or hit the like button, whatever it is you can do, where on whatever platform you're listening to this on. I will say our YouTube feed, somehow they kind of correct my voice. It's not quite as gravelly or allergy laden as it sounds on some of the other ones. So you can always go to YouTube and you can go into their search box and put in Old School Guns Podcast and it pops right up. So anyway, this is Old School Guns out.